This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you tuned in for our regular visit with the political junkie, Ken Rudin and the junkie are on hiatus this week. He'll be back next week. The deaths of Roy Disney, Farrah Fawcett, and Michael Jackson are among those noted on the front page this past year. This hour, we take time to remember those less well-known, but people who we ought to remember, too. We've asked a few of our colleagues here at NPR to tell us about people they knew, and we want to hear from you. If there's somebody you knew or knew of who died in 2009 that you think we ought to remember, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation and find more tributes on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And we'll begin with some emails that we've received over the past couple of days from Jennifer in Oberlin, who nominated Richard Miller, a former voice professor at Oberlin Conservatory. She wrote, "Mr. Miller taught many singers who've gone on to brilliant stage careers, including several Met Opera winners and one of the tenors in Il Divo. More importantly, he tried to bring a scientific anatomical approach to the study of singing. Too many vocal teachers offer baffling image-dependent advice. Hang the tone on the tip of your nose was one of my favorites from my years of study. Mr. Miller was determined that every singer who attended his master classes or sang in his studio would know the precise way in which the human body produces sound and how to make the body do that most efficiently. His office was papered in prints from Gray's Anatomy, and he had a lab full of laryngoscopes, breath monitors, voice prints, recordings, and other tools to help him figure out what made the great voices truly great and how the rest of us could improve what we do. He was the singing equivalent of the sports doctors that put your swing on the computer frame by frame to analyze and improve it. He's influenced singing and the teaching of singing for a generation of vocalists." And from Aaron in California, Emily A. Mazzoni, who passed away on September 10th of this year, "I'd like to share that Emily was a smart, resourceful woman who began her teaching career in a one-room schoolhouse in the woods of Pine River, Minnesota, at the young age of 19. She journeyed to California in her 20s, ending up in Hollywood, where she worked as a companion to silent film star Clara Bow. I loved hearing stories of this time in Tinseltown, where she, a naive Minnesota transplant, didn't know much about pouring drinks or mingling among the rich and famous. I finally remember one story. One night at a party, my grandmother was asked to fix drinks for Clara and her then-husband, Rex Bell. She managed to find two highball glasses and proceeded to fill them to the brim with whiskey. Nothing but whiskey. I was fortunate enough to have had her for nearly all of my 31 years of life. She is sorely missed." Joining us now from Nairobi in Kenya is Gwen Tompkins, known to listeners as NPR's East Africa correspondent, though many of you may also know that she is a native of the great city of New Orleans. Gwen, great to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Happy New Year. And Gwen, I know you're here with us to remember someone known as, one of those people who embody the spirit of your hometown.
It's true. I wanted to talk about my friend Chappie Hardy, who died in June of this year. And so tonight I'm actually in Nairobi. I'm making pralines, which is, of course, the quintessential New Orleans candy. And I'm thinking about Chappie. You know, he was a wonderful man, and I was by no means his close. But every time I saw him, he treated me as if I were. And in fact, he was the first person to suggest that I might like broadcast, you know, and I might be interested in broadcast news.
And you don't hold that against him.
I'm sorry, what?
And you don't hold that against him.
Well, some days I do, actually, you know, because I started my career in journalism at the Times-Picayune newspaper in New Orleans, and I was writing the obits. You know, I was an obituary writer, and I wrote the weather. And, you know, it was a wonderful way to learn about what made New Orleans great, you know, and the people who made New Orleans great. And what I love about this show that you all are doing at Talk of the Nation is that, you know, this is reminding everybody about what a wonderful world this is and how great, you know, it is to live in it. And the thing about Chappie was that he reminded us about that all the time. You know, he was an extraordinary character. You know, officially he was a documentarian, and he wrote and produced documentaries about New Orleans. And then he also worked on other people's feature films, you know, a lot of those films being made in New Orleans. And, you know, I just looked him up on the Internet database, and it listed one of his credits as production oracle. And I thought, you know, that's a perfect way to to describe Chappie. He was a real production oracle.
Well, Gwen, in one of your previous lives, you were also the editor of Weekend Edition Saturday and arranged to have Chappie Hardy on the program to talk with Scott Simon. And here he is discussing his favorite Mardi Gras song.
It was a little ditty from the musical Bluebeard. And since the Grand Duke Alexis came down here literally kind of sniffing after old Lydia Thompson, all of the bands would play If Ever I Cease to Love, just as to kind of tweak him a little bit. And it's played in a number of different ways. You can play it bouncy. You can play it as a dirge. I mean, I even had the organist at my father's funeral play If Ever I Cease to Love. I believe that If Ever I Cease to Love really is the classic New Orleans Mardi Gras song.
If Ever I Cease to Love, and Gwen Tompkins, I'm sure your head is nodding to that beat.
Indeed it is, actually, and I'm so glad you played it. I want to dedicate it, if I could, to his son, Zephyr Hardy, who is also a great New Orleanian. You know, Chappie, you know, his family tree dates all the way back to, you know, the French colonial period in Louisiana. He was a real blue blood, but he was also sort of a blue blood who knew how to live, and he just was so able to show people how to enjoy themselves. You know, he always collected friends around the city, and then he collected friends around the nation, you know. And through his work in film, you know, he met all those Hollywood types. You know, he was friends with John Goodman and, you know, Taylor Hackford and all the, you know, all the guys who like to come to New Orleans and stay for a while. But what was really fun about Chappie was that he made local people feel great about the city too, and you know what I mean, feel happy about being here. Well, being there, I should say. I feel like I'm in New Orleans now, even though I'm halfway across the world. But, you know, when he was on Weekend Edition Saturday, he sort of came with us for a summer, and he talked about finding affordable and delicious eateries around the South. So we would talk to him from week to week about where he was going and what he was eating. He'd bring his own fork. And he went from Louisiana to Arkansas to Alabama and Florida. And then when Katrina came, he actually, you know, evacuated up to New York, and he ate his way through Manhattan. And then he ate his way through the Jersey Shore.
Which can be great fun. Gwen, thank you so much for being with us today. We know it's late there, and we appreciate you staying up to share your stories about Chappie Hardy.
Well, I'll stay up all night to talk about Chappie, believe me. And thank you for the opportunity. Chappie Hardy is a great man.
NPR East Africa correspondent Gwen Tompkins with us on the phone from her base in Nairobi in Kenya. 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. Let's hear from Craig. Craig calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, I'd like to suggest Wayman Tisdale.
As basketball player or as musician?
As both.
Okay.
He helped put Oklahoma basketball on the map right along with football, and was a great college, Olympic, and pro basketball player, but also a really good jazz musician and someone who spread the word a lot like Oral Roberts through music.
And did you were you a fan of one or both, or did you know him?
Both. I actually used to work in the neighborhood where his one of his girlfriends in Tulsa, but just would see him around town, and he was always making people smile. He always had a smile on his face.
He was said to be not only perhaps the tallest jazz musician, but one of the nicest as well.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for the call, Craig.
You bet. Thank you.
Wayman Tisdale. Let's go to an email. This from Jack in Charlotte, North Carolina. In an era where we know every celebrity that has died or misbehaved in 2009, do we know the names of one wounded or fallen soldier? Please honor the people who gave everything in 2009. And this email from Todd Bell in Little Rock. I will greatly miss Frank McCourt. I discovered his second memoir, Tiz, in about 2002 when I found the audio version at a discount bin at Books A Million. I've listened to it at least 15 times over the years. The unabridged version is 14 hours long, and it only cost about $8. That may be the best investment I have ever made. He will always be my favorite author. Let's go next to Jeffrey, and Jeffrey's calling us from Cincinnati.
Yes, I'm calling to talk about the demise of Sam Maloof and James Krenoff, who were two of our leading furniture makers and very important people in both the education and design of contemporary furniture here in the United States.
For what were they best known?
I think Sam Maloof is probably best known for his rocking chairs. They're the ones with really beautiful wood and continuous contours and those rockers that come back and then sweep back down in the back. I know that there's one in the White House, and they're quite well known.
And Mr. Krenoff?
It's kind of hard to describe his style. I mean, both were excellent teachers, but especially Krenoff, and he's very well known for his cabinetry and attention to detail and using the color and figure in wood, as well as a lot of the shapes, a lot of Oriental influence, and very light design.
And it sounds as if these furniture makers made their products in small quantities.
Relatively, it was quite a backlog if you were hoping for a Sam Maloof chair, I think at least 6-9 months or more, and you also had to have a fair amount of money. I think they were going for about $30,000 apiece.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. That's Jeffrey calling us from Cincinnati. And let's see if we can go now to remember other people we lost in 2009, people whose contributions made an impact on the way we live and the way we see, hear, and interpret the world. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And this email from Aaron: I will deeply miss the voice of Blossom Dearie, who passed in February, I believe. Thank God we live in an age of vinyl, CDs, iPods, and downloads, so that she's never far away.
A trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things, if we thought of...
I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation. Stay with us on NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This hour, we're celebrating the lives of people who may not have made the front pages when they died, but whose lives made an impact. As we put together our look at some of those people who we lost in 2009, who may not have received that much recognition, we're asking you who you would like to remember. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. This email from Joe Smith about someone many people here at NPR knew, Cheryl Flowers, the longtime executive producer of Public Radio's Tavis Smiley Show. He writes, "You all know that producers are the unsung heroes of radio. The hosts get all the attention and praise, but it's the producers who do all of the work to make the hosts look smart. Cheryl's energy will be much missed." And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Mike, and Mike's calling us from Lawrence in Kansas.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to remember my mom, Diane Turner Ford. She died in July of this year in a car accident in Moss Point, Mississippi. She worked as a librarian at Lincoln Park Elementary, and she helped her parents. She took them in when they lost their homes during Katrina, and she was from Chalmette. And that previous caller made me remember a lot about my mom in New Orleans. Thank you.
Yes, and obviously, Mike, this is something that's still very powerful for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call. We'll miss her, too. Let's go now to one of our correspondents, Karen Grigsby Bates, and she joins us now from NPR West, our studios in Culver City, California. Karen, nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Neil.
And who do you want us to remember on this day?
I'd like you to remember someone that President-elect Barack Obama put in his acceptance speech on election night. Her name was Ann Nixon Cooper. She was maybe the oldest person who voted for him last year. And in his speech, he said, let me see, I have it here.
I think we have the clip of the speech, in fact, right here. So let's listen to it. This is President-elect Obama as he addressed the enormous crowd in Grant Park in Chicago on the night he claimed his election victory back in November 2008.
This election had many firsts and many stories that will be told for generations, but one that's on my mind tonight is about a woman who cast her ballot in Atlanta. She is a lot like the millions of others who stood in line to make their voice heard in this election, except for one thing. Ann Nixon Cooper is 106 years old. She was born just a generation past slavery, a time when there were no cars on the road or planes in the sky. when someone like her couldn't vote for two reasons, because she was a woman and because of the color of her skin. And tonight, I think about all that she's seen throughout her century in America, the heartache and the hope, the struggle and the progress, the times we were told that we can't, and the people who pressed on with that American creed, yes, we can.
Then President-elect Obama and, well, Karen Grigsby Bates, you knew Ann Nixon Cooper pretty well.
I did. I came to know her a little bit when someone called and said, you know, she's gotten so much attention since the president-elect mentioned her in that speech. There's been media, there's been this, that, and the other. She is 108, or 107, I'm sorry. She's probably not going to be with us too much longer. And it got us to thinking we'd really like to have a history of who she was before she got to the point that she became nationally known for a couple of minutes mm-hmm. by the president. And so I went down to Atlanta and spent some time with her, talking with her about her life before the president called her name. Mm-hmm. And she did. He was right. She had an extraordinary life. She grew up on a little farm in Bedford County, Tennessee, a little town called Shelbyville. Her father was a tenant farmer. Her mom was a stay-at-home mother. She was the third youngest of eight children. When she was about 11, her mother died quite suddenly. And back in those days, dad had to go out and work. There was no one to watch the children and probably not much to keep body and soul together. And so what happened to her is what happened to a lot of children back then. The family was broken up and sort of parceled out to relatives. She ended up going to live in Nashville at a time when Nashville's middle-class black community was doing quite well. And she lived with her father's brother and sister-in-law, who treated her like a second child. They had a grown daughter, or almost grown daughter, who considered her a little sister, and she was petted and adored and had a wonderful life, and then met the love of her life when she was still barely out of high school, and he was a dental student at Meharry, which is the black medical college in Nashville. And after a couple of years of serious courtship, they got married, moved to Atlanta. He started a dental practice, and she kind of became a fixture there. So she died on the 21st of this month. And at her funeral on Monday, last Monday, the 28th, what a lot of people kept saying was so many things that exist in this city would not exist if Mrs. Cooper hadn't decided, well, there's needs that aren't being met, and we can't sit around and wait for people to do these things for us. We have to go ahead and do them ourselves.
And it sounds like we may want to know a lot more about Ann Nixon Cooper, and fortunately, we'll have the chance. A book by Ann Nixon Cooper and Karen Grigsby Bates comes out next month. It's called A Century and Some Change, My Life Before the President Called My Name. It must have been a privilege to get to know her.
It was. She was a delightful person. You know, you think we sort of segregate out elderly people here in the United States. Other cultures are sort of fully integrated and revered even. Here it's kind of like, oh, I'm going to go visit Grandma again. People loved visiting her. She was full of life. She had a very snappy sense of humor. If you came in and she thought you didn't look as well as you could, she's like, honey, why are you wearing those flat shoes? You know your legs will look better if you get in high heels. Let's go off and get you some high heels. She felt very strongly that you needed to go where you could to get the best with what you had. And one of her grandchildren told me, you know, Granny would scare us because we would come up and we would want to go do the grocery shopping with her. And she would steer us away from the nice big grocery stores and say, no, 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 let's go over to Big Bear. Well, Big Bear is a local grocery chain in Atlanta that tends to be located in neighborhoods that are on the economic margins. And sometimes they're not always that safe. And the grandkids would be saying, we really don't need to be in here. And Mrs. Cooper would say, yes, we do, because you cannot get a good ham hock at the Safeway. We are going to Big Bear. And she would go, and they would go with her, because you kind of have to just travel in her orbit. So she leaves a big hole. She has a large family, but she was sort of the top of that pyramid, and they're going to have to realign themselves in order to figure out what next in some ways. And I think Atlanta in some ways. There are several, as I said, several institutions. There's a series of daycare centers. There's a literacy program. There are several books book clubs that she started, and she began actually the first Black Boy Scout troop in Atlanta because the troops weren't integrated in the 1930s, and she thought that the principles and practices that the Boy Scouts stood for would be a good thing for Black boys to be exposed to, but they couldn't become Boy Scouts. And she wrote to the Boy Scouts in New York and said, tell me how to start one because I'm going to do it with or without your help. And they sort of gulped and said, yes, ma'am, and sent instructions, and Troop 95 still exists.
Karen Grigsby Bates, thank you for telling us a little bit about Ann Nixon Cooper and for where to go to good ham hock in Atlanta.
You are welcome, and happy Almost New Year.
And happy Almost New Year's to you, too. Let's see if we can get another caller in on the line. And this is Michael. Michael with us from Calistoga in California.
Well, hi, Neil.
Hi, Michael. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I want to remember my father-in-law, Ken Harris, who was just a fabulous guy with a wonderful sense of humor. He was an Army veteran and a pharmacist for all his working life, and he kept working right up into his 80s. Just up until a few weeks before he passed away on November 22nd here, and he had five kids and a lot of grandkids, and he was kind of a ham, actually. He was a barbershop quartet singer and had a lot of fun with that, and he asked us, my wife and I are musicians, and he asked us to learn this this corny George Burns song called Old Bones, to back him up so he could sing it and record it to play at his own memorial service. And you can see it. It's posted up on YouTube there. It's Ken Harris, Old Bones. And it's kind of melancholy, a little bittersweet, because he was only 1 week from his passing. But he still wanted to sing, and he's got a great smile, and he was just a wonderful guy. And I feel very privileged to have known him for 36 years, longer than I knew my own dad.
Ken Harris, Old Bones on YouTube. But we'll go take a look at it.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael, very much for the call. Here's an email that we have. This from Linda in Missouri, or Linda Joe, I think, in Missouri. Mike Seeger, the Seeger family, has been a major part of the history of traditional and folk music in writing original music and in documenting traditional music. I had the joy to play with Mr. Seeger at a music festival a few years ago in Arkansas. He was a great musician across many instruments, but he was a magnificent teacher. He played my pre-1900 banjo prototype. He told me never to sell it, but if I did, to contact him. Well, I'm never going to sell that instrument. It will stay in the family with the memory that was appreciated by Mike Seeger. I should also mention Mike Seeger has been a guest on this program a couple of times, too. We will also miss him. Let's go now to NPR's Margo Adler, a correspondent who joins us from our bureau in New York. Margo, nice to have you on the program with us today.
It's a pleasure.
And who do you want us to remember on this day?
Well, I want you all to remember a man named Arnie Sacker, who died this September. And for almost 40 years, he called radio stations and really pushed conversations in a direction that I would say was truly meaningful. You know, when we look at, when we listen to talk radio these days, we think about very strident. We think about people saying, you know, this is what I think about Iran, or this is what I think about healthcare policy. But what he would do is he would push the conversation to really existential questions, such as, how do we do work that's truly meaningful? How do we allow passion, sensuality, ecstasy into our lives? How do we stop being defined by the boring jobs many of us hold? He lived alone in Queens. He never finished college. He never had a real career. He certainly is, you know, he was somewhat disabled, and yet he would call all these people up at different radio stations and at different programs, and he would try to sort of say, look, let's look at sort of eternal questions. And when he died, just all kinds of radio people came to his funeral. He, at one point, he was involved also with a little tiny literary magazine called And Then. It still publishes. About 800 copies come out. And here's just, I'd love to read just a paragraph in it of his last essay, because it's so different than anything we think about. I was always maladjusted, sympathetic to drifters and dropouts. Today, liberals and progressives seem to opt for good schools, decent jobs, a more humane inclusion into the American dream. Perhaps they think that's all they can get. I've come to fear that's all they want. I was an anarchist hippie. I was a poor student in school. I never held a job. All my life I was deemed freakish, unable to cut the mustard. This remains the ground of my politics. It still informs my vision of a society without hierarchy and domination. Some call this ineffective politics. At some level, I do not care. I need to keep my vision to preserve my soul. I cannot think or breathe otherwise.
Wow, that's good stuff. And and only appropriate that on this program we should remember a caller.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Margot, thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
NPR's Margot Adler, our correspondent in New York. We're talking about those we missed who died in this past year. It's the annual Obit Show on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email that we have from David Moss. I lost my father July 4th of this year from a massive heart attack. He was a 24-year veteran of the Kentucky State Police. As an on-the-road trooper for the last 13 years of his career, a detective in drug enforcement and special investigations, Steve Moss began his career in September 1975 and rode school buses in Louisville, Kentucky during the forced busing riots. He served the Commonwealth of Kentucky with distinction and balanced home and work as best as anyone in his field could. He had many accolades during his career, but probably the best is that I don't know them. Dad did his best, even when his cases were in the media, to shield my family from the talk of the community, and he went to work every day to make our Commonwealth a better place. What qualifies him as a memorable obituary for 2009 would be, after being retired for almost 10 years, his funeral filled the funeral home with family, friends, his colleagues, at least one person who he arrested were there to pay their respects. I don't know what mark he left on our community until that day. I'm sure he didn't know either. There's obviously a lot more information to share if you'd like to contact me, and he provides his information below. And so he's remembering his father, who died, Steve Moss, on July 4th of this past year. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Mary. Mary with us from Little Rock.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to remember, well, my mother, first for being my mother, and also recognizing that she touched so many lives before her tenure as the first black female appointed to the Arkansas State Supreme Court and to the Arkansas State Court of Appeals.
This must have been a difficult row at points.
It was very difficult, and actually she had encountered so many barriers during her adult life as a woman and as an African-American, and she just had a philosophy of pushing forward and really kind of, I think, branching out of her comfort zone, because she started out as a scientist. She wanted to be a field zoologist like Jane Goodall, but she was told that she couldn't go in the field because she was a woman. So then she decided to go into law once she relocated to Arkansas with my father, because unfortunately she was encountering a lot of discrimination as an African-American. And she branched out with what started out as a small private African-American law firm, and did kind of just mainly what, you know, as unglamorous, kind of grunt work, but also played a mentoring role with a lot of her clients. And based on her integrity and her passion as an attorney, and the work that she did in the community with my father, she ended up getting the attention of both a Democrat governor and a Republican governor, who both appointed her at different times.
Remind us of her name again?
Andre Roaf.
Thank you, Mary, for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye. And here's another email. This we have from, I don't have a name here, a friend. My friend Christy died at 39 after a 10-year fight with breast cancer in New Orleans. Christy spent her time fighting, but spent her life living. Warm, funny, beautiful, and vain, Christy reminded so many that life may hand you lemons, but you have a choice as to whether you become bitter or use them to highlight your hair. She is sorely missed. Coming up, we'll discuss more undersung lives we lost in 2009. Another email. This is from Michelle in Washington, D.C. My unsung hero for this past year is my brother Jeff. He was not only the hero of my childhood, but a good friend of all who ever met him, and had the most infectious smile and laugh. He committed suicide in May. My mom and I are still shocked, along with all his friends. How could someone so loved be so deeply sad? So now, in addition to having already inspired me to be good to the people I love, he daily inspires me to tell the people that I cherish just how much I love them. Who do you want to remember? Emails talk@npr.org. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, it's our annual Ovid show. We've asked our friends and colleagues here at NPR to remind us of some of those we lost this past year but should remember better. And we'd like to hear about the people you're remembering today. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. We've received hundreds of emails. That email address is talk@npr.org. We got this one from Kathy in Whittier, California. My relative William E. Smith passed away this year at 87. He served in World War II on Guam as a radio expert. He built a real-time computer called Recomp in the late 1950s, which was grabbed up by the military and put to use in missiles. I wonder what would have happened had that computer found its way into the private sector. He was a good person, and we'll miss him. And this email from Eric in Minneapolis. Please remember modernist ceramicist Ruth Duckworth. While perhaps not a household name, Ms. Duckworth was influential and a driving force in making ceramics a legitimate part of the fine arts. Her sculptural works ranged from large-scale architectural installations to intimate porcelain forms. I saw her work at a retrospective show at the Minneapolis Institute several years ago. I completely changed my understanding of modernist art and has influenced my own work ever since. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Wendy. Wendy with us from Glenboro in New Jersey.
Hello.
Hi, Wendy.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I'd like to remember my mother-in-law. Her name is Narcissa. She died suddenly in the end of September. We didn't know she was even not feeling well. She's an artist, first and foremost. Many media, but largely a painter. She taught many people. She ran writing groups and taught art to everyone from children to the residents in a continuing care facility, which is where she was had multiple studios till the end of her life. She worked with clay and people paint birdhouses and did all sorts of things. But something not too many people know about her, besides being raised Catholic but a Quaker as an adult and then a Baptist toward the end of her life, she went to Washington, D.C. at one point in her life and somehow got herself into the gallery and was complaining out loud about some things that were happening at the Senate and was thrown out because women weren't allowed in the gallery
uh-huh.
at the time. And then later on, they had to kind of change that rule.
you knew she had to be a tough person. Anybody who goes through life with the name of Narcissa.
You got it.
Yeah.
She did fit her name fairly well, but she raised four kids, two of them without a dad for quite a while, and did all kinds of amazing things and touched many, many lives. The church, which I thought was huge, was far overflowing with people when we had her service. And I'm sure there will be people that hear about her today that didn't know she passed who might be glad to hear, at least to know. But
Wendy,
thank you very much.
We're sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Juliet in Kansas City. I'm remembering Ronald Tataki, the influential historian whose groundbreaking work, Strangers from a Different Shore, convinced me to focus my studies on Asian American history while in college. He changed a lot about the way historians and others examine the complex stories of race in our nation's history. I'm confident that the next generation of American historians will continue to expand on his important work. Well, joining us here in Studio 3A is a voice many of you are familiar with early in the morning, Paul Brown, a newscaster here at NPR, and if I may say so, also a very talented musician. Nice to have you with us, Paul.
Good to be here, Neil.
And you're remembering a fellow musician.
A musician and a music collector. I'd like to talk for just a moment about Ray Alden, who passed away in September of this year. Ray, Neil, was an unusual person in that he not only wanted to learn music, he developed a tremendous set of social skills through which he brought hundreds, if not thousands, of people together around a subculture of traditional old-time mountain music and related musics here in the U.S. and eventually even overseas.
And one of the things that he did was to collect. In fact, we have a clip of a tape of him playing. Set this up for us, if you will.
Sure. This is a song called Visits, which Ray wrote after he'd been collecting music in the Mountain South and elsewhere for a number of years. And he recorded it with a number of his friends. And it came out on a double LP years ago in which Ray featured His visits with old timers in the Mountain South and some of the younger generation of musicians who'd come along.
Well, let's listen to a bit of the music of Mr. Alden. Ray Alden playing there. And Paul Brown, you not only knew him as a musician, he was your friend.
Absolutely. Ray was a friend to me as he was to many, many other people. He had a remarkable ability to set up, if you will, a sort of a gravitational field around him that just drew people to him. And he encouraged young people and old alike to make music, to go out and hear music, to record it, to learn from the old-timers as much as possible, and had a what became a really unusual ability to do that. A lot of folks in our little subculture will go out and make recordings of musicians, for example.
Sure.
You'll head to the mountains, and you'll get to know some old folks and record them. But how many folks will draw in hundreds of other people and then do what Ray Alden did in 1995, which was to found an organization called the Field Recorders Collective? And this brought together a group of other collectors to aggregate their recordings and make them available to the public at large. And the FRC has now put out nearly 70 CDs of field recording sessions made at people's homes and other venues, which would otherwise simply not be available. Ray didn't want these recordings to get lost in giant archives where they were inaccessible to most people. He wanted them out there, and that was Ray's spirit all the way along.
Well, thank you very much for sharing. Paul Brown, you obviously can't see in the studio. Paul Brown, you know he's a newscaster because he wears his earphones on one ear only, on the left ear. That's the one way you can always tell somebody whose first love is the newscast in the mornings. And Paul Brown, I should also point out,
hear the rest of the world that way, Neil.
Hear the rest of the world that way and avoid going deaf in both ears.
Right.
But the fact is, among earlier incarnations, he once had administrative responsibility for this program, and he is lucky enough to escape that. But anyway, Paul Brown, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Paul Brown, you hear him every morning on National Public Radio newscasts. This, an email we have from Richard Harris in Bethesda, Maryland. I lost my neighbor who was a fixture for walking his beloved Sheltie, whatever the weather, but many folks who may have seen Jack Nelson taking his dog for his nightly constitutional may not have known that Jack was a giant in the journalistic life of the nation. He was a superb investigative reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner who broke major stories in the civil rights era and led the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau during the tumultuous Watergate period. Jack was also an inspiration for many of us who followed him in the journalism craft. I already miss seeing him taking his stroll with the dog through the neighborhood. And that from yet another person who used to have administrative responsibility for this program, our friend Richard Harris. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Shelley. Shelley with us from Kansas City.
Hi. I wanted to remember Helen Howard. She died in July, and she actually died in D.C. She was living with her daughter at the time. But when I was growing up, she was the organist and the music teacher for my church and for my grade school. And in November, we had a memorial service for her, and numbers of her old students and kids that sang for funeral masses with her, who are all now in their 40s and 50s, we all showed up because she'd given us a lifelong love of music, of making the best of what you had in terms of a lot of small kids with voices singing in church. And it was not only just the huge amount of the older people that showed up, but it was all of kids from all over the country that basically came back in to go to her memorial service. And it was, to me, she, outside of being one of my best friend's mothers, I mean, it was a great tribute to her that all of these kids came back because they wanted to thank her for having been there when we were little.
What was her favorite music?
Well, she always used to like to, she loved playing the organ. She could not play really any other instrument but the big pipe organ at church. And but she used to warm up by playing polkas on the organ before Mass.
That must have been something to hear.
And And one of my favorite memories was we did buy a new organ at the church, and when they were putting it in, they had the big, huge, like, building lights up in the choir loft, and she had to wear a big sun hat while she was playing because she couldn't see the music. So if you looked up from, like, the altar up, you would see her in this really gaudacious sun hat, you know, while she was playing the organ.
Shelley, thank you for that vivid picture of Helen Howard.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Here's an email from Gayla in Tulsa, Oklahoma. A great woman died in 2009 on the same day as Natasha Richardson. This amazing woman was named Hari Gawain Tefera, and she almost single-handedly rescued many children who were the earliest victims of the AIDS crisis in Ethiopia. Please apologize if I mispronounced her name. Her story is chronicled in the book There Is No Me Without You by Melissa Faye Green. After the loss of her husband and daughter, Tefera reluctantly agreed to take in two of Addis Ababa's thousands of AIDS orphans. Soon children of all ages began to appear at the door of her tin-walled compound. She eventually transformed her home into an orphanage and began facilitating adoptions to homes all over the world. This book and this woman are especially important to me, as my family and I will be traveling to Ethiopia this spring to adopt a young girl into our family. It's the annual Obit Show. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Kat. Kat with us from Berkeley in California.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I'm reminded today of my mother, who died about 2 months ago. Her name was Christine Kennedy of Palatka, Florida. She was a wonderful woman, very kind and generous, and I was made to think of her today because of your earlier show about transplants. If she had lived for 2 more months, my mother would have maintained a transplanted heart for 20 years.
That's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, and she maintained that heart by being such a wonderful and compliant patient. I watched what effort it took for her to keep herself going, to follow her doctor's instructions, to live a life that would enable this heart to continue to live within her. And I wanted to say she provided an example to me and everyone she knew. And so also to remember all the other people who have received organs and done what their doctors told them and provided the proof that we can use the organs of those who have passed on, that we can have this wonderful medical addition to the world, that we can have a transplant society. And she just lived that every day. And it was very hard work, and she showed what you got back for it. So I miss her.
Kat, thanks for sharing her memory with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. This email from Debbie in Columbus, Ohio. Gail Storm, who starred in My Little Margie, died the same weekend as Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett. Given the timing of her death, it went somewhat unnoticed. She was a remarkable woman. She has 3 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TV, recording, and radio. I believe she was the first celebrity to step up and do a public service announcement about a personal battle with alcoholism. My family became friends with her, no matter how much pain she endured at the end. She maintained that positive, sweet attitude that she carried throughout her entire life. She will be missed. Let's go next to Andrew. Andrew with us in Boulder, Colorado.
I'd like to remember Muriel Rosen, who with her husband Arnold were the founders of the Appalachian Summer Festival, and they were also major benefactors at Appalachian State University that brought all forms of music to the people of the Appalachian region.
And what kind of music did she particularly was she particularly fond of?
She was particularly fond of opera and classical, but they brought all forms, including country and ballet, all kinds of things, to the Appalachian Mountains area.
And enabled many, many people to see kinds of performances they would never have seen or heard otherwise.
Absolutely.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Paul Dow writes us, please remember my mother, Lillian S. Robbins, who died of natural causes this year at 88 years old. She was raised in an orphanage and was one of the first 100 women to join the Women's Marine Corps during the Second World War. She was a true American hero, always doing for others without thinking of herself. And this email from Jan Down in Iowa City, Dr. Ignacio V. Ponseti is a hero to thousands of people, parents, children, physicians, and all those who have known of his work. Over the course of his life as an orthopedic physician, Dr. Ponseti developed a non-surgical method, now known as the Ponseti method, of correcting children's congenital clubfoot through gentle manual manipulation and a series of casts followed by a brace. Dr. Ponsetti, a native of Spain, fled there during the Spanish Civil War. He eventually arrived in Iowa City at the University Hospital to do his orthopedic residency, where he realized that surgical correction of clubfoot was not the best treatment. He continued to see patients until well into his 90s, and he died in October at the age of 95. This also from Thelma Riggs in Tulsa. She remembers her son, Mark Allen Thompson. No, he was not a Broadway, TV, or movie celebrity. He was a teacher. He touched the lives of hundreds of young people as he taught English and drama in junior high school. At Mark's memorial service, I met a young woman who had been in his English class. She was so inspired by him that she decided to become a teacher. I would like him, along with all the other teachers who passed away in 2009, to be remembered. And we'll end with this email from Penny in Eugene. While it is nice to recall those whose names we can easily recall, such as Walter Cronkite, Michael Jackson, Don Hewitt, B. Arthur, it is equally important, if not more so, to remember those who fight and risk and give their lives for our freedoms, our soldiers, our sailors, our Marines, our airmen, and our Coast Guardsmen, in this time of reflection on the years on the year past. I mention these folks because our family includes members of all the various branches of the military that protects our great nation. God bless and protect them, everyone. And Penny, we thank you for that. And we'd also like to thank all of our colleagues who joined us today and everyone who wrote and called in. And literally, we've gotten hundreds of emails. We thank you so much for that. And I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all. To read additional remembrances from NPR staff members, including Felix Contreras on musician Jose Reyes and Dennis Herndon on Irma Henderson, the mother of Detroit. There's also one I wrote of Arnold Stang, one of the great voices in radio that we lost this past year. You can go to our website at npr.org. Special thanks to producers Sarah Handel and Beth Novi for putting that together for us. Tomorrow, Stephen Landsberg's book of brain teasers, The Big Questions. That's tomorrow on This Is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.